Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the war in Iraq changing the world? And are any of those changes likely to benefit the United States in the long run? My guest today is not alone in lamenting what he sees as major mistakes in America's handling of the war on terror, but he's not ready to place the blame entirely on the Bush administration, nor on the Clinton administration that preceded it. In fact, he says neither major party really understands what we're up against, or even are able to acknowledge the real reasons why Islamic extremists hate the U.S. Michael Scheuer spent more than 20 years with the CIA in positions that included chief of the agency's Bin Laden unit. His latest book is called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So President Bush and Presidents Clinton and Bush before him have framed our problems with Islamic terrorism by asserting that they hate us because they hate freedom, because they hate our way of life. What tells you that's bad logic?
Well, I think there's always been a disconnect in the logic that identifies someone who's willing to kill himself to overthrow the police state of Saudi Arabia or the police state of Egypt as a freedom hater. There's a disconnect there. But more important, you have to, I think, at least take the enemy's professed convictions at face value. And there's very little in the rhetoric of our enemies that suggests that they're fighting because we have women in the workplace or primaries in Texas or because we have civil liberties. They're fighting against us because of the impact of our foreign policy in the Islamic world. And I think that's because that's their motivation, they're a much more dangerous enemy than any of our political leaders in either party have suggested to the American people.
And we essentially cling to that argument that doesn't hold up to scrutiny, you think, because we don't want to face the idea that they have a structured argument against U.S. foreign policy.
I think we much prefer them to be judged as nihilistic and gangsters and fanatics. And I think on the whole, if America was up against an enemy that was crazy, we would be much better off. These are very methodical thinkers. They're very pious, religious people. And they're very convinced that our foreign policy is an attack on their faith and on their brethren. And America doesn't have to, no American has to accept that as valid. But what you do need to accept if you're going to defend our country is you have to accept the fact that that's their motivation, not the silliness about blowing yourself up because you or I might have a cocktail after work.
Another perception that troubles you is that al-Qaeda is made up mostly of impoverished people, people who are very ignorant. They have very little to live for. What do we know specifically about the makeup of the group itself and of also its sort of outside supporters on the fringe?
Well, we know on the whole that al-Qaeda, the main group of al-Qaeda, is comes from the middle class and the upper middle class in the Islamic world, people who have educations, people who come from functioning families, not dysfunctional families. And according to Mark Sageman, who is a forensic psychiatrist, in none of the cases has he's been able to examine, has he identified any mental pathology. So we're up against a well-educated enemy. In many cases, we're fighting the best and brightest in the Islamic world. I think on the surface, if so much has been made about al-Qaeda and its allies using the Internet as a method of recruitment, of spreading propaganda, of teaching. And if you step back for a moment, it would seem odd for a group to spend so much of its resources on the Internet if they were appealing to the illiterate. So it's a very, very well-educated group. And unfortunately, our politicians in both parties have told Americans over the past 30 years that, as you said, terrorism comes from poverty, from illiteracy, from unemployment, and that just is not true.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. He's former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. His book is called Marching Toward Hell. Would capturing or killing Osama bin Laden today change the terrorist threat against the U.S.?
It would disrupt it. It wouldn't make the difference it would have made, say, 10 years ago. But he is a very unusual man, a very talented man. I think you could argue with some plausibility that no one has changed the course of American history more than he has for the negative over the past 50 years. Whether it has to do with Americans' trust in their government, their worries about attacks within the United States, the difficulties of air travel, our way of life has been changed by this one man, and he leads an organization which is absolutely unique in the Muslim world. It is multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual. And so I think just on the basis of the bare talent he brings to bear, he deserves to be taken off the scene. I think it would be a mistake to capture him. I don't think we want him on CNN and the Arabic satellite televisions for 3 years in the Southern District of New York. I think it's very important, though, that we do close the story on his life, that he deserves really to be dead. It's very important for American security, and I think we need to press forward with that.
I'm glad you brought up Arabic satellite television. I'm wondering if you can talk about the way that perception of sort of shared fates and shared threats and common enemies has changed since much of the Islamic world has been able to consume the same media every single day.
Well, I think the views of, you know, it's always been rather amusing to listen to our State Department and our government be very upset over the past 20 years anyway with Arab satellite television reflecting Arab views. It's like being surprised that American television reflects the American audience. I think what's happened is the Muslim world is now getting a version of the news, an interpretation of the news that meshes with their own religious, political, social realities and is not just a window into the West. It's not surprising that, generally speaking, the tone of Arabic satellite television is anti-American, or at least anti-United States government. One of the oddities we have is that while we say bin Laden and what he represents is a very small segment of the Arab world, the polling that's available that's been done by Western firms over the past 12 to 15 years show that 80% of Muslims worldwide share the same view of American foreign policy that bin Laden has, although only a very small portion of that number would pick up AK-47s to fight us. But the reflection of the United States government and its policies in the Arab media, especially on television, is pretty much akin to bin Laden's perception of that same issue.
So you said that killing bin Laden today would disrupt but not eliminate the terrorist threat to the U.S. However, 10 years ago, it would have been different.
Yes.
That time frame was within the Clinton administration. You were still working there at
Yes.
the time. Was there not an order by Bill Clinton to try and kill Osama bin Laden?
Never one that I knew of, ma'am, and I was in charge of those operations. I think between Mr. Clinton and Mr. Berger and Richard Clark, there's been a great amount of post facto self-defense. There was never an opportunity to kill, or there was never the authorization to kill Osama bin Laden before 9/11 that I was aware of. And since I ran operations, that word was not going to get to the field unless I was told about it.
So do you think Sandy Berger's assertions that the president put that order out are simply trying to protect his own legacy?
I think they're simply lying. You know, Sandy Berger is a felon. And a self-admitted felon, and we'll never know what papers he destroyed to protect the president. President Clinton, like President Bush before him and this President Bush after him, the last thing they want Americans to know is that protecting Americans is not their first priority. And so they will do whatever they need to do to keep that fact from the American people, that they'd rather see dead Americans than offended Europeans, for example.
Yeah, you have talked about sort of an America First policy, which would eliminate all international intervention that doesn't directly benefit Americans. What are the criteria for that exactly?
I think what you do is you go to war, you use your military, you intervene when it's something essential to the interests of America. Take, for example, women's rights. Within America, that has to be a top priority for all politicians and all parties. But it's hardly an issue of national security overseas. The idea, as is happening now, that a young Marine or a young soldier, male or female, dies so Mrs. Mohammed can vote in the Afghan parliament, to me is pretty close to criminal. America has really very few genuine national interests that require warfare to defend. Freedom of the seas, certainly. Freedom to fly around the world. A freedom to defend ourselves. Unfortunately, we have to have oil, so we'll have to fight wars now and in the future to secure oil. But other than that, America has very few interests overseas that would require us to intervene in other people's wars and other people's arguments.
You've made the argument that our relationship with Israel yields far less, even when it's working perfectly, than it costs us in terms of foreign entanglements and terrorist threats. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't think, in my own perspective, Israel is not worth to the United States a single dollar or a single life. They're engaged in a life and death struggle with Islam, and it's other people's religious wars. It's not our war. The benefit that we get from the relationship with Israel might be huge emotionally. It has virtually no payoff for America, and certainly what we're seeing now is Americans not only paying an immense amount to support Israel in terms of money, but we're beginning to pay lives. And I'm afraid with the way things stand that neither Mr. Obama nor Mrs. Clinton will get out of Iraq, because once they become president, one of them, they'll fully realize that there's nothing worse for Israeli security than an American withdrawal from Iraq. So once they get into power, they'll begin to see certain nuances, if you will, that will require us to stay there.
You don't think there's any chance that John McCain will become president?
Oh, I think there is a chance, but there's a foregone conclusion what he's going to do. He said he will stay there 100 years. In fact, I think he probably has a better chance than the other two, because they're going to make a lot about this business of, are you experienced enough? Clearly, Mr. Obama has very little experience, and the media has let Mrs. Clinton get away with the claim that she has anything more than one-point-something terms in the U.S. Senate. But it doesn't matter, because all American politicians read from the same script in foreign policy, and it all comes down to intervening everywhere at all times. Just this last week, for example, all of them, Mrs. Clinton, Mr. Obama, Senator McCain, President Bush, most of the Democratic Party, most loudly Senator Biden, applauded the Declaration of Independence of Kosovo from Serbia, and indicated America supported that. Well, we have absolutely no interest in that part of the world, and yet what they've done is support an action that has lit the fuse for another Balkans war. And when the Serbs move, and they will, with Russian support, to eliminate an independent Kosovo, America's prestige will be on the line, and NATO and the United States, whether it's under a Democratic or a Republican president, will waste our fortune and our young people's lives on a silly war in the Balkans.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. He's former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. His new book is called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. We will take your calls after this quick break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. After the break, we will also talk about what Scheuer thinks we should do in terms of a modern Manhattan project to develop alternative fuel technology that would make us independent of foreign oil producers.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Michael Scheuer. His newest book is called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. If you want to join us today, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Mike, you said earlier that America's foreign policy in that region has basically been to intervene everywhere all the time. Is it possible to pull away from any of that until we don't need the region to be secure enough to provide us with oil?
Chris, I think oil is the beginning of our ability to restore some options to U.S. foreign policy. Until we do that, we are tied to the Gulf states, which, of course, each and every one is a police state. And one of the Islamists' claims is that all of our talk about democracy is really just hypocritical, because we support and protect Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates. So we need to stop really thinking of oil and energy as simply an economic issue and think of it as really a national security issue. And to the extent that we become less dependent on the Persian Gulf in the Arab Peninsula for oil, I think it will become apparent that there's nothing on the Arab Peninsula that's worth the life of a Marine or a soldier. But it's a broader issue than that, even on energy. For example, I have read by 2012, America will get 20% of its crude oil from the Gulf of Niger, from the Niger Delta, the Gulf of Guinea, rather. And the reality is, on energy, America has frittered away its independence on the decision to go to war or to remain at peace. If something happens today in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where the oil is produced, or something happens that disrupts production in the Gulf of Guinea, we will go there with our troops and our forces to restore that production. So it really is in the interests of the United States to move on this issue with some dispatch. We've wasted 35 years. We get better mileage, but we use more oil now. And the only real advance you could claim is the paltry moving of daylight savings time up 3 weeks. And so we really need action on this. This will allow us to have some options for policy in the Middle East, which don't exist today.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Michael. Mike, I've been listening to you for many years now since you left the government. You're very provocative, and I look forward to this time to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
Two quick things, very quick. You've made the point that they don't want to kill us for our way of life, which I agree with. It's not Oprah. It's not women can vote. But our economic way of life requires us to intervene in foreign lands, you know, the corporation following the flag, to get the oil, like you've just meant. So isn't our way of life truly creating the problems, because our military has to be there to support the oil? And secondly, since you've left the government, have you been more effective in educating or getting your message out than you were in the government? Because I've heard you a lot, but again, nothing's moving politically to kind of reflect your views. But you sound very logical and very educated. So how effective have you been, or are you being, or will you be?
On the first one, I think at least in the terms of energy, you're exactly correct. As long as we do not move with dispatch and with imagination to become, to the greatest extent possible, self-sufficient in energy, and unfortunately or fortunately, depending how you look at it, that includes nuclear energy and more drilling in the United States, we are going to remain an interventionist power. And perhaps more so over the years to come if we do nothing. Since I've left the government, I can't claim to have had much success at all. Really, the only thing I've had is the freedom to speak my mind. I think I've agitated a number of people. Someone told me the other day that there's something in my new book for everyone to hate. So I guess there's something, that's some kind of an accomplishment. But it's a very much an uphill struggle, sir. Look, there's been virtually no questions in any of these debates about foreign policy. I really think that the candidates now are very happy to be in this kind of quasi-area, are we in recession or not recession, because people have turned away from any interest at all in what is going on overseas to be worried about, in a very traditional American manner, pocketbook issues. So I can't claim to have had much success at all. I resigned from the agency not because I had anything against CIA. I loved it there. But I thought it was time to at least try to be a good citizen. I know that sounds corny, but the world looks very different to intelligence officers who are gathering the information for our political leaders than the world that our political leaders describe. So if I can add some additional element to the debate now and again, I'm happy to do that, and I judge that as a success. But I would admit that it's very much on the margin.
Your first book, Imperial Hubris, was initially published anonymously. Did something change about the perception of the book after it was revealed that you had written it based on your position?
I think that people, it was anonymous, first of all, because the agency would only let me publish it that way. I had asked to use my own name, but because I didn't want to be accused of hiding behind anonymity. But the agency required me to remain anonymous. After it was revealed, I think I had a little more credibility because whether or not people agree with my analysis, it was clear that I had at least some experience. I had 20 years of experience or more on American foreign policy in the Muslim world. So I think it gave me a little bit more credibility, and it made me less, the last thing I wanted to do was to be regarded as a cloak and dagger kind of spy, because I wasn't. I was a manager of covert operations from the United States for most of my career. And so I think in the long run, it cleared the air, and I think it's been helpful.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. His newest book is called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Chris, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Scheuer, currently I'm reading your new book.
Well, thank you, sir.
This is book number 3.
Yes, sir, it is.
Why do you think that no one in government seems to share your view of the situation? Don't they know where it is in the Library of Congress?
Well, it's one of the unusual things is I dealt very extensively with Congress, of course, while I was a CIA officer, but really the only person that contacted me after I resigned was Mr. Paul. I think intervention abroad is the gospel for both parties. And I argue in the book that I think we talk a lot about class divisions and other sorts of divisions in American society, black and white and Hispanic, and linguistic differences in rich versus poor. But I really think that the major class division in the United States is between our political class and everyone else, because they're willing to spend the lives of our kids and our taxes overseas on things that make them feel good, rather than taking care of things at home. I live here in Northern Virginia, for example, and I watched President Bush overseas last week or the week before, spending $700 million in American tax money to assist the Tanzanians against AIDS and other AIDS and AIDS-related diseases. Now, God love the Tanzanians. I hope they do better, but the rate of AIDS infection in the Northern Virginia area is higher than some sub-Saharan countries. So I have a very hard time understanding why so many of our political leaders in both parties assign a higher priority to helping or intervening abroad than they do to helping Americans or protecting Americans. I've not been able to understand that. And I think the media fails dreadfully in not presenting these questions to the candidates.
Well, very often the argument's made that they don't come from the same pot of money, for example. What do you make of that?
There's only one pot of money. The federal government has no money. It all comes from our pockets. We have, as a people, decided that we've legalized thievery in the sense that we see the need for taxation, for military, for national defense. But I'm darned if I think that any American family should be without enough money to pay for heating oil during the winter or to not be able to afford an education for their children. And the money, we spend $4 billion a year to support Hosni Mubarak's police state in Egypt. There's no way in my own mind to reconcile that, to make that an acceptable disservice to the American people.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. He's former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. We're talking about his new book, Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Anthony in Fort Worth. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Michael. Just want to say thank you for being a truth teller and coming out and talking about this. It's sad that our government likes to make up fantasies on why things happen across the world. But my question and comment has to do with, you mentioned Dr. Paul, Ron Paul, running for president, and what you think about his position agreeing with you on foreign policy and what horrible things could happen to our country if he isn't elected or someone else isn't elected who understands what's really going on. And I'll take my question or the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think Dr. Paul is a very courageous man, and I disagree with libertarians on a lot of things. It angers me when they're very critical of Abraham Lincoln, and I'm not sure I'm a gold standard guy. But Dr. Paul has had tremendous courage to say, listen, you ought to tell the American people that we're at war because of our foreign policy. Dr. Paul or myself on a less important level are not saying blame America, hate America, it's America's fault. What we're simply saying, I think, is that the motivation of the enemy needs to be understood. And until you understand that it's our foreign policy and not our women in the workplace, we're going to get beat in this war. But, we all watched when Mr. Giuliani was still a candidate. He all but called Mr. Paul a traitor, an anti-Semite, an American hater. So it's very hard to get this discussion going. But if we keep up with the commitments we have, adding to them this week, as I said, with Kosovo, we already have been told by people who are supposed to know that our military is stretched to the breaking point. How much further can we go? And I think all of the discussion in this presidential election year about universal health care and fixing Social Security, all of that's been interesting discussion, but of course there's no money for any of it. Our money is going to continue to go to military interventions and other kinds of interventions overseas. So is as much fun in a way and as interesting as this campaign has been, the crucial issues over the next 4 years, I think we'll find, are not going to be domestic issues, but more and more involvement in military activities overseas.
Mike, is it all or nothing with regard to Israel, or is there some option that exists between our current level of support and dropping the country flat that would potentially cause some sort of implosion in the region that is worse than what it is right now?
Well, I think, first, I would preface that by saying we need to remind Americans that Israel ceased being an underdog once they acquired a nuclear arsenal and a whole arsenal of WMD that's unaccounted for. But if we were really interested in protecting a relationship with Israel, one way to do that is to turn Muslim anger back on the countries that are its main enemies. We're not the main enemy of the Muslims, the Islamists. It's the countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Egypt, the police states that have oppressed Muslims for the last 50 years. So one would think that, at least in America, that segment of the population that is most pro-Israel ought to be the most pro-energy self-sufficiency. Because if we can get the Islamists focused on attacking the Saudi government, for example, that allows us room to maneuver and perhaps, if you believe it's necessary, maintain a relationship with Israel. I don't think it has to be all or nothing, but I don't think we can simply stand still and say we're not changing anything because people will think we're appeasing the enemy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Michael Scheuer. His book is called Marching Toward Hell. Let's go next to Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
It's an honor to speak to you, Michael. I've been a long
You're very
time
kind, sir.
Thank you. It seems like whenever someone becomes a true expert in terrorism or Al-Qaeda, like you are at the CIA, the powers that be don't want to listen to you. I think even though maybe your views, not everyone agrees, I think you probably get a better hearing now in the public with your books than you did when you were at the CIA and had the ear of congressmen and the president. Is there something about the hard truth that people just don't want to hear, or is it that special interest groups or individuals try to drown out deeper thinkers like yourself? And I don't mean
No, sir, I wouldn't like to respond to that in a general sense because I'm not knowledgeable into all fields. But in our field, in my field, on Al-Qaeda, Islamist extremism, terrorism, I think you have to look first to the enemy. There is a touch of genius in Osama bin Laden in focusing on the American foreign policies he focused on, rather, are inextricably tied up with domestic politics. For example, any politician who is going to take on the issue of Israel in a negative way amounts to a suicide operation for that politician. We've seen that over and over again. No politician wants to run on the issue of we need to pay more for energy so we can break our dependence on foreign energy. No one wants to say, for example, that we're sending your children overseas to protect the government of Saudi Arabia so it can continue raping the profits from its country's oil reserves. And so as a result, I don't think our politicians are stupid. I think they understand that our policies are the main motivation of the enemy. I just think they value office more than the protection, at the most selfish level, of my three young granddaughters. And so they keep it at the general ridiculous level of they hate us because we have primaries in Iowa every 4 years.
Michael,
I think it's a clear lack of political courage and a clear preference for office over Americans.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. We'll be back after a quick break, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
The book we're discussing is Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Michael Scheuer. His newest book is called Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
At KERA.org. Mike, I'm wondering if you'd talk for a minute about what the interpretation tends to be when intelligence experts expect some sort of attack to take place and then it doesn't materialize.
Well, we have a tendency to view the Muslim world and our Islamist enemies through a mirror that we are really looking back at ourselves. We spend a lot of time expecting attacks. And one of the besetting problems of the United States government over the past three administrations, at least, is that we believe that if they haven't attacked us when we expect them to attack us, it means either we have prevailed and are victorious or that they don't have the capability to attack us. And one of the things that's so vastly different between our culture and theirs, and something, frankly, that I still have to learn every day, is our perception of time. When you or I say something is going to happen soon, we're thinking about tomorrow, the next day, or maybe the latest, a week from now. Soon in the Islamist mentality is very often years down the path and sometimes generations. And so we take a false comfort from the fact, for example, that we haven't been attacked since 9/11. We somehow think that that's because we've prevailed over Al-Qaeda and prevented it. But the very fact that anyone can get across our borders at virtually any point, either from Canada or Mexico, clearly indicates that we're not any safer, really, than we were in 2001. And I think the problem is they have decided just not to attack us yet.
An email from Jim says, I thought it was a mistake to have gone into Iraq, but I think it would be irresponsible to pull out now and leave it in chaos or leave it broken up into terrorist states. What's your response to that?
Well, I'm not one who is a pacifist. I think that if an issue is important enough for America to go to war, we should indeed go to war with our whole heart, if you will, and bring all of our power to bear. But we're clearly not going to do that under Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Obama or Mr. McCain. We would need probably three or four times the number of troops we have in Iraq to stabilize the situation in any way in a permanent manner, and we're not going to do that. So at the moment, every life we lose is just a wasted life, and every billion we spend is a wasted billion because we're just putting off the inevitable. I think it's, for example, on this whole issue of the surge, I think it's disgraceful in the way Americans have been misled. There has been a successful surge, but it's been Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army that has surged toward a ceasefire to allow us to kill Sunnis so they will have fewer to kill when we leave. So staying the course, if I thought we were going to stay the course and reinforce to the point where we could secure a victory, that would be one thing, but we're not going to do that. We're going to either withdraw or we're going to stay at an ineffective level and bleed. And so my own preference would be to get out right away.
Michael Scheuer is my guest. His new book is called Marching Toward Hell. Let's speak next to Martin in Saxe. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Hi, Martin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, sir.
A very interesting show. I had a question. I understand your non-intervention philosophy. And I was wondering what you thought about as far as genocide. I don't know if this is your expertise, field of expertise, but like, for example, during World War II, you know, should resources have been used to bomb the railroad tracks to concentration camps? Or as far as what's happening in Sudan today, you know, a lot of people think there's genocide going on there.
I think World War II is not a particularly pertinent example simply because we went to war to defend ourselves against Hitler after he declared war on us. Unfortunately, I don't think America can be in the position of going to the rescue with military forces. It ends up being a refocusing of anger against Americans. We should always be there with food and medical supplies and educational assistance if we can from our surplus. But Mr. McCain's rather mad idea of sending soldiers and Marines to get involved in the civil war in Darfur, where there is no American interest at stake, I think would be a tragedy. And for America, it would simply refocus more of the Muslim world's hatred on us as another example of American intervention in a country that has oil. So you have to be careful in how you do these things. Ralph Peters, who I think is one of America's best strategists, said at one point, we have to learn to watch others die with equanimity. And it's a very hard, almost callous thing to say. But before I would lose American youth to in an intractable situation like Sudan, I would do everything I could to prevent it.
An email from John in Dallas asks if you would speak to the issue of demographics here in the U.S., immigration, conversion, birth rates, and how these stubborn facts will alter the character of our confrontation of the Islamist threat.
You know, I have to say, first of all, I'm not a demographer. I think we've been very fortunate in comparison to Europe, for example, that a lot of our Arab population is Arab Christian population. We have a growing number, though, of Muslims in our country, but our country has had a history of being able to assimilate people to a greater extent into the equity or the equal opportunity of our system than certainly Europe has. But over time, we're seeing a change in the attitude of some of our Muslim population. Polls last summer showed that up to 30% of Muslims under 30 thought that at some point suicide attacks were useful in defending their faith. The State Department put out a communique late last year that more American Muslims attended the Hajj in Saudi Arabia this year than ever before. And most of them were young professionals, exactly the kind of people that al-Qaeda appeals the most to. So I think America has a problem. I hope we can settle it. I hope we can assimilate Muslims as we have all other people who come to our country. But I think it's a problem we're going to have to keep an eye on.
Let's go next to Bert, who is waiting patiently in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. You know, the Bush's war on terror has really blurred the line between a lot of these fights now. The insurgency in Iraq is all about our presence and the fight for power between Sunni and Shia. And, of course, the Taliban are just wanting to take back over a country they formerly ruled, and there's a lot of tribal issues involved there. How much is the original al-Qaeda, if bin Laden's still alive, but Zawahiri and those people that have survived our attacks and are still there, wherever they are in Pakistan, how much of that group is really directing operationally some of these attacks, like the connection between London and whatever they've done in Iraq? Can you kind of give us a better idea what you think is operationally, how active have they been, and what would be their capabilities in the future if we did get out of Iraq and eventually Afghanistan?
Well, I think al-Qaeda itself, the core group around Osama bin Laden, which he commands, has always been a relatively small group, and they have never looked at themselves in the first instance as a fighting organization. They see their goal, their job, as being a vanguard to incite other Muslims. Their really main military activity is to support insurgencies, Islamic insurgencies around the world, and their main military goal is to attack us. But their top priority is incitement. And I think they remain capable of attacking us. They remain a very coherent organization and a very professional one. The problem for the West and for the United States is the very success they've had in incitement. They have been very successful in creating groups or encouraging the creation of groups around the world that follow their theology, are incited by them, and do things in their name, but entirely without a command and control mechanism. The people who attacked the subways in London were clearly in contact with al-Qaeda, but there was no command and control relationship. What we're seeing is a whole new tier of threat that's emerging. And unfortunately, if you take the London examples over the past couple years, again, it's in the middle and upper middle class people, most young Muslims. My goodness, the last one we had in London was five very qualified Muslim doctors who were involved in an attack. So we're looking at two different tiers of threat now. One directly from al-Qaeda, the other one instigated by al-Qaeda, and therefore much harder to detect.
How would you say, Mike, that military campaigns against al-Qaeda stack up in terms of effectiveness against the rendition programs that essentially seek to identify potential terrorists and pull them off the street?
Well, I was, for better or worse, one of the authors of the rendition program, and I managed it for about 40 months. And it's odd because it was never meant to be the whole of the American counterterrorism program. It was meant to be a complement. Like special forces are a complement to military operations, not the main military operation. Unfortunately, rendition has become the major tool against the terrorists, and it's just not capable of winning the day. Our military operations have been mediocre at best, not because of the soldiers, but because of the politicians. The politicians in both parties are very afraid of international condemnation if they use the full weight of our military that the American people have paid for. And so as a result, what we're seeing is, to avoid that international condemnation, especially from the Europeans, more and more presidents of both parties are turning to covert action, to intelligence operations. And while we can be effective, the intelligence people can be effective at the margin, we cannot win this war. And so I think the rendition program has been extraordinarily valuable to America. But it has done a couple of things. It has weakened the leadership of al-Qaeda, or at least removed the first generation of al-Qaeda leaders. But we're fighting an organization that puts tremendous amounts of effort into succession planning for leadership. They expect to lose people. They have lost people, and they're replaced by very qualified people. So at best, we're making a dent. We're not leading to victory. But the political class in this country just will not use the military that their taxpayers have paid for.
Critics of rendition have argued that it's been somewhat capriciously applied.
Well, that was never my experience, ma'am, and I can only speak until 2004, but I know people who are still involved in it. If anything, it has been less effective than it could have been because of legal restrictions under both governments, under both Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush. Under Mr. Clinton especially, it was a very limited program because he did not want to hold anyone under American authority. He had us take everyone that was arrested to Egypt or to Saudi Arabia or to Jordan or to an Arab country where they were wanted for a legal process. I would say it's exactly the opposite of what people perceive it. There's no cowboyism in it. No one has ever been picked up because a CIA officer had a hunch. You have to prepare a dossier of information that is akin to presenting something to a court, and then you have to have lawyers approve it. Now, I can't guarantee, and certainly the case has been made, that the information available is not always as accurate as we would like it to be. In the aftermath, it turns out some things are wrong. But that does not say that there was not a thoroughgoing vetting of the information before the operation was undertaken. So having lived through it, having run it, I'm afraid I would come down on the other side of that argument.
Mike, are acts of terrorism that might be committed on U.S. soil still a greater threat to our way of life than the very strong measures we might take to prevent those acts here on U.S. soil?
I think yes. We have known, for example, since at least 1996, that al-Qaeda was searching for a nuclear device to use in this country. We're not their main enemy. Their goal is to get us out of the way, in a sense, so they can go after the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Israelis. And we've known that since 96. It wasn't sufficient for President Bush to go after, or for President Clinton to go after bin Laden in Afghanistan. It wasn't sufficient for President Bush to go after and kill him at Tora Bora. I think that that's still out there. And, another question for the candidates ought to be, why 17 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, only about 42 or 45% of the Soviet nuclear arsenal has been secured.
Michael Scheuer's book is called Marching Toward Hell. Mike, it's been a great hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, ma'am.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.